As the country celebrates its 250th birthday, we remember the Corps of Discovery exploring the Louisiana Purchase, which doubled the size of the new nation. I'm David James, and next on 2 Main Street, we relive the epic journey with Craig Fairman, author of the new book, This Vast Enterprise, A New History of Lewis and Clark. The more than two-year-long expedition covered some 8,000 miles, braving rapids, hostile tribes, and a threatened mutiny by the crew. We learn more about Meriwether Lewis, the soldier scientist, his co-captain, William Clark, Clark's slave, York, and a pregnant native girl, Sacagawea. It's 1803, Jefferson is president, and the mission is to find a direct water route from St. Louis to the Pacific Ocean. 2 Main Street is next, presented by the Berger Wren Group at Bayard Private Wealth Management. From the WNIN Public Media Center in downtown Evansville, I'm David James, and this is 2 Main Street. Okay, keep your powder dry, your canoe steady, and watch out for friend or foe at the next bend of the river. Your co-captains on this Corps of Discovery are Meriwether Lewis and William Clark, and the company includes a small group of Army regulars, a slave, and hired civilians known as the Kentuckians. Later, they will be joined by a pregnant native girl, Sacagawea. It's a more than two-year, 8,000-mile journey through mostly uncharted territory. The explorers battle Mother Nature and human nature and pave a path for westward expansion. Here to guide us on this epic journey that changed the landscape of a fledgling nation founded 250 years ago is historian and author Craig Fairman. His new book is This Vast Enterprise, A New History of Lewis and Clark. Craig Fairman is a graduate of the University of Southern Indiana and is also the author of Author-in-Chief, The Untold Story of Our Presidents and the Books They Wrote. So, Craig Fairman, welcome to 2 Main Street and welcome back to Evansville.
Well, thank you. I'm so excited to be here.
And you have family here, don't you?
That's right. My kids are with their grandparents right now watching Looney Tunes, and we're going to have a lot of fun. They might be having even more fun.
All right. Now, your new book, This Vast Enterprise, is filled with great characters, plenty of drama, conflict, even frontier sex. And it's not fiction, is it?
Nope, it all happened. We have these wonderful journals from the expedition. That's one of the things that makes this so fun to write about. They left behind more than a million words. I can't think of any equivalent of this for any event in American history. So to have those journals, but then also to have Native perspectives, Native history, and to be able to bring it all together, it makes a great story even more more delightful.
And you researched this for how many years?
5 years.
5 years.
Yes.
And I know... At the back of the book, all your sources are incredible.
Well, thank you.
And a lot of interviews?
A lot of interviews. Yeah, I interviewed more than 100 people, actually. And I think sometimes people don't think that historians should do interviews, but I find it enormously helpful. Some of the interviews, I would talk to academics, somebody who's an expert on air rifles in the 19th century. I didn't even know there were air rifles in the 19th century. So, I need help there. But definitely the interviews that helped me the most were with Native sources. So for each Native person that I spent a lot of time with in the book, I tried to interview Native people today. And they just helped me understand the worldview, understand the values, understand the goals. And those interviews, they let me know how serious the story was, how much this story mattered to them, just like Lewis and Clark matter to a lot of Americans. And they also really informed my writing. I owe so much to those interviews.
Now, I know in the book you have a cast of characters, and there's a long cast of characters here, but that kind of keeps you involved in the history of this book and the adventure of the book as
right.
Well.
Well, I think when most people think of Lewis and Clark, people have probably seen this on, family road trips. There are those brown signs on the side of the highway, and it's just two guys, right? It's just Lewis and Clark, and that's what most people picture. But, it's right there in the title, Vast. This was an adventure that involved lots of people, not just Lewis and Clark, but their soldiers, Native people. You mentioned some of them in that great introduction. So it was really important for me to show that this was not a story about two people. This was an ensemble story. And I think that makes it a better story. When you have more people, more goals, more desires, that just makes for a more entertaining story.
Of course, there have been a lot of stories about Lewis and Clark, and this is why your story is different, do you think?
I think so. I've always wanted to write a big adventure story. And so after I wrote Author-in-Chief, I was sort of poking around what's next. And when you think American adventure story, Lewis and Clark is the first one that comes to mind. So I started reading those journals. I didn't read all million words at first. I eventually read them a few times. But at first, I was just kind of poking around. And I was just like, I only know half the story. I'm a historian. This is supposed to be my job, but I really only know from those previous accounts half the story at most. And so that's when I realized I need to dig deeper. And the deeper I dug, I just kept finding amazing human beings, amazing sources. I found a lot of new documents. And I was just like, I want to tell the whole story. I want to bring both sides together. And I just want to make this a very human, complicated, messy story, because that's what it was. That's the truth. And I wanted to get the truth on the page.
A lot of chaos involved. Yeah, it didn't go as planned, did it? No.
Life never does, right?
Okay. Now take us back to 1803, a new nation, Thomas Jefferson is president, and the United States suddenly doubles in size with the Louisiana Purchase, $15 million. I think it was 4 cents an acre, something mm-hmm. incredible like mm-hmm. that. So we have this brand new nation, Jefferson anxious to explore the land because the British, French, Spanish, even the Russians mm-hmm. have been there. And the mission is to find a water route from St. Louis to the Pacific Ocean. Of course, waterways were the transportation routes for trade at that time.
That's right. That's right. They were the highways. That was how you got from one place to another. But there was also another level of importance, which is that waterways were important to imperial claims. And one thing I really try to do in this book is sort of show how did power really work in 1804, 1803? How did politics really work? So the Louisiana Purchase is a great example. It's easy to see those maps and say, oh, America doubled in size. Here's the before, here's the after. But that's just not how it was in reality. It was so complicated because native people still owned the land. Mm-hmm. What America bought from France was the what's called the preemption rights, the right to negotiate with those native people. So there were sort of two discussions happening at the same time, which was various empires having their discussions. But then there were the people who owned the land, held the power, controlled the rivers. That was the native people. And so Jefferson was constantly thinking in both in terms of both discussions at the same time. And so he needed information, which is one thing that Lewis and Clark did. They went out there and they said, you know, hey, if you want to deal with imperial powers now, it's not France, it's not Spain, it's America now. Some native people, and honestly, the Spanish and the French didn't necessarily agree with that. There was a lot of different people competing for a lot of different things. But one of the things they did was sort of explore those rivers, because if you could control the river, then you could claim more of the land. But again, the claim was only the first start. You had to actually buy the land from the native people, work on treaties before anybody could move in or change anything like that. And one thing I just tried to show again and again in the book is that native people were the ones who held the power right now. Lewis and Clark knew this. This is not me imposing a modern viewpoint or something like that. This is just the actual reality in 1803, 1804. Jefferson said, you know, we have to make a good impression on the Sioux. That was the term he used. Today we would say Lakota or the Ochetisakouan. But Jefferson said, we have to make a good impression on the Sioux because in their part of the country, we're miserably weak. That's a direct quote from Jefferson. So the Corps of Discovery was an amazing thing, but part of the reason they were courageous is because they were going so far from where America's power bases were. They were going into native country where native people set the agenda. And again, that just makes it a better story. It's not two heroic Americans going through a wilderness. It's two heroic Americans going into an act of foreign policy and really negotiating with these other countries. It's fascinating. It's like Game of Thrones.
Yeah, and hostile territory. They didn't know what they were going to go into.
Some hostile, some friendly, and they just didn't know. You know, every time they would meet a new native nation, that was part of the uncertainty and that war on them.
And a small group, too. It's not like a big regiment going there.
Right. Jefferson's original plan was for 10 to 12 people. There'd been previous expeditions that size. And Lewis, I think, very intelligently realized that's not enough people. First of all, the Missouri's current is too much. We can't move our boats with all our stuff without more manpower. But also, he realized that having more people would make them safer and make the native people realize this is something new. This is something to take seriously. So still a small group compared to, you know, you meet the Lakota and there's hundreds of people. Hundreds of soldiers from the Lakota, only 40 or so from the Americans. But it's the stakes are high.
Mm-hmm. And it's on their turf, too. They know the land.
That's right. That's right.
Right. Now, our co-captains, let's go kind of a bio on who was Meriwether Lewis?
Sure. Well, he's a fascinating guy and a very important American. He grew up in Virginia, grew up pretty close to Jefferson. Clark grew up in Virginia, too. And so Lewis was a soldier. And when Jefferson became president, he wanted to get a secretary. Now, secretary might seem like a not that important of a job title, but honestly, it's closer to what a chief of staff would do today. So it was a very important position. He would go meet with Congress, sort of be the in-between for Jefferson and the legislative branch.
And there was kind of a bromance between these two guys.
I think so, yeah. Like they were very close. And I think they recognized that they both cared about the same things. They cared about the West. They cared about America. They cared about expansion. And so there was also a mentorship there that Jefferson was older. Lewis had lost his father at a very young age. And so I think one of the things that makes the expedition such a human story is that Jefferson had his big geopolitical goals, but he also was sort of sending his protege out there to do something big and brave for the country they both loved.
Lewis, of course, is a kind of a complicated character in the military, and he faced a court-martial, didn't he?
That's right. The documents are never quite as revealing as we would like, but I think it's pretty clear that some drinking was involved. Lewis was somebody who... Let's use Jefferson's word, because it's really important for me in the book, again, not to take modern categories, modern understandings, and impose it on there. We know enough from 1804 to tell the story the way that they saw it and experienced it. The word Jefferson used was that Lewis had depression, sensible depressions of mind. And so Lewis was somebody who his entire life struggled with depression, with, you know, the dark parts of his personality, with addiction. And so those kind of manifested, I think, in that court-martial. But to Lewis's credit, he was able to overcome that. He kind of gave his own testimony to win the trial of the court-martial. And one thing that really sticks out to me for Lewis, again, reading those journals, we have so many words to study, is that you can see that Lewis understood his own mind. He would analyze his mind. He would say things like, you know, I tend to focus on the negative, or I tend to worry about the future. And then he would remind himself, don't do that. You know, look for the positive. Stay grounded here in the here and now. And I just find that so heroic that Lewis struggled with these things, but then worked to stand up to them. He didn't always succeed, but he tried. And I mean, isn't that what we're all doing every day?
Right. Now, this incident was at a dinner or something, and he insulted a superior officer, and they're going to have a duel?
Right. Well, we have to remember that in 1804, this idea of personal honor was a really, really big deal. And so there was a dinner, older officers. Lewis was an officer himself, and so Lewis kind of stormed in, started running his mouth. We don't know exactly what they were talking about, but if I had to guess, it would be politics. We can talk about this too, but you know, politics today is a dicey subject, right? Politics in 1803, also a very dicey subject. Right. And so they ended up having a fight. A couple of the witnesses said that Lewis broke down and started weeping because he was so angry. Lewis left and then came back and said, I want satisfaction, which was obvious code for I want to challenge you to a duel. And this other guy, kind of in a cowardly mood, accused Lewis of being drunk and sort of tried to hide behind the army rules. Instead of just accepting the challenge of the duel, he kind of said, let's just get this guy in trouble and then I don't have to fight a duel. And so the important thing to remember is that Lewis cared a lot about personal honor. I think that's one reason the expedition meant so much to him. He understood Jefferson's big picture ideas, but it was Lewis's name on this expedition. Everyone in America was reading the newspapers and following along. This was a viral news story. This was national. This was international news. And Lewis knew that if it succeeded or failed, he was the person who would get the credit or blame. He had such a strong sense of personal honor, and that drove him, but it also cost him things too.
Well, he wanted to impress Jefferson too. He wanted to fulfill Jefferson's mission.
Absolutely.
Okay, who was William Clark? I know he was a slave owner, right?
That's absolutely true. And that's one thing that's interesting to say is that Clark also grew up in Virginia, pretty close to Jefferson, although the Clarks ended up moving to Kentucky, near Louisville, because they wanted to access to the better land there. But even though Clark and Lewis had very similar backgrounds, you know, both grew up in Virginia, both from wealthy families, they still were very different people. And one thing I tried to do in this book is understand how each person saw the world. So Clark was a slave owner. One of the people that he owned was named York, who I'm sure we'll get to talk about a lot. Mm-hmm. He's one of the best people in the book, I think. But yes, Clark was a slave owner. He came from a family of slave owners. Lewis, interestingly, and this is one of the new arguments in my book because other people haven't really engaged with this, I think the evidence is pretty overwhelming that Lewis, he didn't disapprove of slavery, but he didn't engage with it. He sort of just stepped away with it. It wasn't his thing. But Clark was fully enmeshed in this institution. It's how his family made their money. It's how his family built their plantation in Kentucky. And so that was really important to Clark. But Clark was also a soldier. He left that plantation for a long time, was a very brave and notable officer, and then sort of left the military, was doing family stuff in Louisville, kind of didn't know where his life was headed. And then one day this long letter shows up from Meriwether Lewis. They had met in the army. They'd actually met in the Midwest in what would become Ohio. And Clark gets this letter that says, hey, I'm going to go on this crazy mission. Do you want to come with me? And the rest is history.
And of course, Clark's famous brother, George Rogers Clark.
Right, exactly.
Hero of the American Revolution.
That's right, a very important influence on them both. And again, if we think about Jefferson as an influence, Jefferson as someone to impress, George Rogers Clark was part of that for William Clark too, where you've got somebody in the family who's accomplished huge things, and that's a shadow that he felt.
So we have the team of Lewis and Clark and getting ready to take this journey. My guest is Craig Verman, author of this vast discovery, A New History of Lewis and Clark. Coming up, we're going to meet more members of the Corps of Discovery, including Sacagawea. Her son, is it Pompey?
Pompey, yes.
Pompey. And then, of course, York. He's a fascinating guy. And some Native leaders. And we'll learn more about my guest. I'm David James. This is 2 Main Street. We'll be right back with more exploration. Welcome back to 2 Main Street. I'm David James. My guest is Craig Verman, author of this vast enterprise, A New History of Lewis and Clark. So tell me about the title of the book, of this vast enterprise. That was William Clark's words to the president?
That's right. Once Clark got that letter from Lewis that said, hey, do you want to join me? Clark wrote back right away and said, yes, I do. Then Clark wrote back again and said, yes, I still do. He was very excited. It was a mission that a lot of Americans wanted to participate in. And so then Clark also wrote Jefferson. They had met before. They had a little bit of a relationship. And what Clark said is, I'm excited to join this vast enterprise. And I remember reading that letter and mm-hmm. that phrase. It's an interesting phrase. It sort of feels old, but it also feels it feels mysterious, I guess. But I also think it's a really fitting symbol for the kind of book I tried to write, that it's not just about Lewis and Clark, although there's plenty of Lewis and Clark in it. It's about all the people that came together to make this mission succeed. And, you know, it was a vast crew of people.
Now, one of the early moments of the journey, they've got all their supplies, had some problems with the boat, I know. Kind of a drunken builder, I think.
Yeah.
There's all kinds of great little stories in this book. Now, Lewis is showing off an air rifle. You talked about you researched an air rifle. I'm mm-hmm. not sure what that was. You mm-hmm. can tell us what that was.
Sure.
But something goes wrong with the air rifle when he demonstrates it, and a woman is shot.
Sure. So this air rifle is interesting in its own right, but I also think it's a good example of how we can kind of look at history a little bit differently. Because previous people who have written about the air rifle have always focused on what it meant to Native people. The air rifle was basically a super-powered BB gun, but it might be better to think of it as a repeater. Obviously, in this time, you know, you'd use muzzle loaders, and so you'd have to put one bullet and a powder in, use the ramrod. It was kind of slow. With the air rifle, Lewis could pump it up. You just have a hand pump, sort of like what you'd use for a bicycle tire. You'd pump up just lots and lots of air. And with that pressurized air, you could shoot a bullet, push a button, shoot a bullet, push a button. So it became much closer to a modern weapon in terms of how quickly it could fire, and it was still extremely powerful and accurate. So this was a really impressive weapon, and Lewis often used it during his diplomatic meetings with Native people, and the Native people were very impressed. But that's all people focus on, and what I tried to point out in the book is Americans were impressed too. Lewis had this in Pittsburgh where he was getting ready to leave, and everybody kept saying, show us your air rifle, show us your air rifle. So to say that this was just something impressive to Native people, that's not what was true in that time period. It was impressive to Americans too. Unfortunately, there were a lot of people who wanted to see it. Lewis did a demonstration. It went great. And somebody said, can I hold the rifle? This is on an island outside of Pittsburgh. The person sort of is inspecting the rifle. You can imagine them kind of looking up, and they accidentally fire a shot. And it hits a woman about 40 yards away. She drops. Lewis can see the blood squirting out. He panics. He thinks, I'm on this great American expedition, and I've started by accidentally murdering one of our own citizens. Thankfully, that's not what happened. The bullet nicked her. She bled a lot, but she was okay. But you can imagine the panic Lewis felt in that moment, the uncertainty, the anxiety. And that's the kind of feeling he was going to have to carry for the next 3 years.
It's not a very good omen, is it?
No, it's not. Huge,
vast enterprise.
That's right.
Now, before we learn more about the main characters profiled in the book, including Sacagawea, we won't forget about her and her friend Otter Woman, is that right?
That's right. That's
right. Otter Woman. We're going to learn more about my guest, Craig Verman. You grew up in Dillsboro, Indiana.
Dillsboro,
it's a small town.
It is a small town. It's a wonderful place, but the closest landmark would be Cincinnati. My wife is an Evansville native, and when I met her when we were both students at the University of Southern Indiana, I told her I was from Cincinnati, trying to impress her as an 18-year-old. I guess it worked because we're still married. But you know, when I actually took her to Dillsboro a few years later, she was like, this is not Cincinnati. but it's a wonderful place that I grew up in, and then I came to the University of Southern Indiana. Met my wife there, made a lot of lifelong friends there, had wonderful professors there, and that's sort of been my connection to Evansville, and we still come back to see my wife's family all the time.
And you went to Yale from USI?
That's right, yeah, I went to grad school. I thought I was going to be an English professor because I love stories, but then when I was in graduate school, I got more into history, And what I like about this job now is I can kind of do both. I can dig in those archives and find new documents, but I can also tell big stories. And I don't have to choose this way. I can have it my cake and eat it too.
Now you're in Bloomington now?
That's right.
And you're at IU?
I teach there sometimes as an adjunct at the media school. I actually teach sports writing, which can't ask for a better place in Indiana to teach sports writing than there with all the sports around.
That's been a good sports year for
IU.
It's
been a great sports year, absolutely.
Now, okay, let's go back to the interior of the North American continent. Mm-hmm. Indian tribes along the route of Lewis and Clark. We meet some powerful chiefs, including Black Buffalo and a warrior named Wolf Calf.
Mm-hmm.
So these are great characters, aren't they?
They're amazing people. And one thing I really wanted to do in this book was give them as much attention as Lewis and Clark, because Lewis and Clark are American heroes, but these Black Buffalo is a Lakota hero. Wolf Calf is a Blackfoot hero. And I think it's a better story when you don't just have Lewis and Clark sort of those two guys on the highway sign, you know, just two guys by themselves. It's sure. much better if you have a story where there are two sides, there are two accounts where, you know, the Americans obviously wanted things from Native people. But let's remember, the Native people held the power in this time period, and they wanted things from the Americans too. And so to understand Black Buffalo and Wolf Calf, you know, Wolf Calf was a young man. He was trying to build his reputation. Black Buffalo was an older man. He was trying to lead his people. So even they were very different. They wanted very different things. And to sort of describe their world and how they interacted with the Core Discovery, those are some of my favorite parts of the book, just to see two worlds come together on what I hope are equal terms.
Mm-hmm. On the voyage of discovery, Lewis and Clark brought along a lot of gifts mm-hmm. to hand out to the Indian chiefs. They had special packages
right.
for the chiefs. I thought right. that was interesting.
Yeah. And this is also where you can see Lewis and Clark improvising and adapting, because they were planners. And so before they left their fort near St. Louis, they packaged everything out. You know, this is going to be for this nation. This is going to be for this nation. They quickly realized, well, there's more nations than we knew about. We don't know everything. There were no maps that they could refer to. There was no Google. So they tried to adapt and sort of redo their packages, but they would often give them military coats, you know, and say, you know, because we picture Lewis and Clark wearing buckskin, and by the end they were, but when they had these big councils, they would put on their military uniforms. So they would look real sharp. They'd have their blue coats, their red facing, all the details, and they would give coats like that to the Native people, which they appreciated, but also, you know, gunpowder, bullets, things they needed.
Early into the mission, the only member of the expedition to die was Sergeant Charles Floyd.
Mm-hmm.
And did he have the appendix burst? What was that?
That's the best guess that doctors have, is that he had appendicitis and then it became infected. And so he would, even if he had been in Philadelphia with the best doctors of his day, he still would have died. It's not that anybody did anything wrong, but that was certainly a worrying sign early on. York, somebody that we've mentioned before, took care of him. They were on the boat. They couldn't stop. They had a mission to do. So they were still trying to move. Floyd was very sick, throwing up, trying to eat, getting delirious. York was there trying to take care of them, and then he died. They gave him a military funeral. Everybody put on their blue uniforms. They found a prominent hill. They built him a coffin. They buried him. They called him their brother. It was very much like the military culture we understand today, because this was a military mission. But, you know, I think when that happened, nobody thought that's the first person who's going to die. We have to remember that today we can see Lewis and Clark and in the full arc, but for them, every day, they didn't know what was going to happen. They didn't know what was around the next river bend. They didn't know who was going to get sick. They didn't know if their gunpowder stores were going to catch fire and explode. Every day was a mystery. Every day was a threat. And certainly something like one of their men dying early on just underlined that.
And he was a key member, a sergeant, too.
He was. And he was from the Kentucky side of things, too. One thing that's really interesting about that is new to my book is I try to pay attention to the dynamics among the men. If you focus right. only on Lewis and Clark, you kind of forget that there's all these men underneath them, that they have different perspectives. So some of them were kind of career soldiers, often from New England. Some of them were more hunters from Kentucky that joined the army just to be part of Lewis and Clark. Those people had very different politics. They had a lot of reasons to kind of butt heads, and they did very much butt heads. And so one of the things that made Floyd important was that he was from Kentucky, but Lewis and Clark promoted him to sergeant. I believe they were sort of trying to heal that divide, you know? Right. So if you have sergeants coming from the military side and from the Kentucky side, you're trying to forge some kind of cohesion. And let's be clear, they did forge cohesion. Their approach as military officers was really unique in this time period and really effective. They were able to build a unit that lived up to the cliches, that lived up to the hype.
Because there was some talk of mutiny there for a while.
At multiple points, it really seemed, not just at the start, but in the middle, it seemed like things were going to fall apart. It seemed like there were the men were ready to quit, or the men thought that Lewis and Clark weren't taking the native threat seriously, or the men were hungry and having to eat horses. There were so many places where things got so bad and so hard, and they were all enduring this together, and Lewis and Clark were able to kind of hang on to that sense of unity and that sense of purpose. But it was hard. Mm-hmm. It was a really hard thing to do.
And we talked about York taking care of Sergeant Floyd. Mm-hmm. York was Clark's slave. Mm-hmm. The relationship between Clark and York, you talk about that a lot, the dynamics between those two.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's a really, because of those journals where we have a million words, we can really zoom in on this relationship. And so what I like to say is I didn't write a book about slavery. I wrote a book about York. And I think it's a different perspective to really get down there and see, well, what did Clark want from York? And what did York want from Clark? And I think one of the most inspiring and surprising things about the expedition is that York was able to get a lot of the things he wanted during the expedition. If you read these journals closely, you can see at the start, Clark has his classic slave owner mentality. He doesn't even say York's name. He's like, this is my boy. This is my servant. Just a very, he sees him as an extension of himself. But the further they get away from America, the more York is able to assert himself, in part because York's a very valuable member of the expedition. Yes, he would nurse and help people, but he was a large, strong man. He was an important builder. He was one of their best canoeists. So when the rapids got really tough, that's when they would rely on York, because York could swim. This is something that blew my mind when I was starting the research. Most of the men in this time period could not swim. It was just something you didn't know how to do. And so the few men who were good swimmers like York were extra important when they were going through difficult water. So York was able to kind of leverage his contributions, and Clark and Lewis and the other men saw his contributions. By the time they reached the Pacific Ocean, he had more privileges, he had more power, he was able to do things he wanted to do. And I think it's important to say that York earned that. York was able to accomplish that through his hard work and through his courage.
And York, being a large black man, he was a novelty to these Native Americans. Mm-hmm. Some had never seen a black man before.
That's right. And in their cultures, I talked to some of the, we mentioned interviews, I would talk to some of my Native sources, and they would explain to me that black was a color in their culture that symbolized war, that symbolized victory, that symbolized success. So if you have somebody show up, their first thought was, is he painted in black
That's
paint?
That's right. They rub his skin.
Right. They would spit on their hand, rub his skin, try to see, nope, this is not paint. So it was something that was very surprising to them. And they saw York as somebody with great spiritual power. And you have to think that had to be really interesting, not just for York, but for Clark, for a relationship that was flipped in America. Now, all of a sudden, there were Native nations that said, the most interesting and important person on this expedition is York. That, again, is a sign of, once you get outside of society, once you get in the middle of this expedition, those power hierarchies kind of invert in ways that are surprising and fresh.
He would entertain the children. He would act like a bear and chase them around the village.
And they loved it. Yeah, Native families thought it was a delight. Thousands of them came to see York because he was a great entertainer and he was having fun. He was making those choices. Clark didn't like him doing that at first. Clark was like, I really wish he would do less of that. Mm-hmm. But York knew, out here, you can't do that in St. Louis. If Clark says don't do that in Kentucky, he's going to need to listen or he's going to get beat. But out here, the rules are changing a little bit, not all the way, but a little bit, and York took advantage.
And the Native women liked him.
That's true. That's true. There's one story of York having sex with a Native woman. There may have been more. The captains did mention this. They were pretty frank about this, and they prepared for it. You know, they had been soldiers long enough to know what soldiers do, and the Native people had reasons to do this too. If we think about Native people as being very rational and very strategic, sex was a way for them to exchange spiritual power, but also make kinship ties. So, you know, if their women had sex with the Corps of Discovery, that helped bring them together and forge those kinds of relationships that then the Native people could take advantage of. The Native women would even negotiate this. They would talk to their husbands and say, well, if I'm going to have sex with this person, this is what we should get in return. This was a strategic and very intelligent and very intentional choice.
Form of barter there.
Exactly.
John Ordway, an Army sergeant all the way from New Hampshire. Interesting character as well.
Yeah, one of my favorite people in the book. And we should say that the book, I wrote it in kind of a unique way for a history book, where each chapter rotates to a different point of view. So we've already mentioned Wolf Calf, Black Buffalo, Sacagawea, Lewis Clark, Jefferson, and Ordway now. Each of those people get chapters from their point of view. Right. And I think that was important to kind of put everybody on the same playing field. And also, I just like biography. I feel like when you're reading a biography, it's a chance to get inside somebody's mind and sort of see the world the way they do. And so I wanted that to happen for Lewis, but I wanted that to happen for Wolf Calf, and I wanted that to happen for York and for John Ordway. And it was important for me to include Ordway because when we were talking about Lewis and Clark, they're both very wealthy men from Virginia. They have a certain kind of life. John Ordway's life was not like that. He was poor. He joined the Army because he didn't have any other options. He really wanted to be a farmer. He really wanted land. And so every day on that boat in the Missouri, he's seeing all this beautiful land that, from his perspective, is not being used the way it should be. That was his motivation. That was his goal. And I really wanted to capture, well, what was it like for somebody who has to do all the hard work, for somebody who's towing the boats and feels that rope just kind of, you know, creating a burn across his shoulder standing in the current, but also somebody who wants land. And so Ordway, I think, was an incredible non-commissioned officer. He deserves a lot of credit for that unit staying together, for those mutinies not happening. But he's also just a really interesting guy.
Now to a famous member of the expedition, Sacagawea.
Sure.
A teenage girl. She was captured in a raid. She had a child with a French trainer.
Charbonneau.
Charbonneau, a child. She acted as a translator. She was a very important member of this expedition.
Absolutely. And again, like York, she was able, she lived in a system that was very brutal. I think of her as a slave. People want to say she's Charbonneau's wife, but that's just not true. And Clark used this word. Again, this is not modern categories. Clark said she was a slave. That's his quote. That's his word. And that's the truth. So she had to deal with sexual abuse, sexual violence. It was a very difficult life. But especially once she got on this expedition, she began seeing ways where, you know, I can help Lewis find the plant specimens that he's gathering for his botanical research, or I can help Clark teach the men how to forage, or I can help find way once they got back to her territory that she knew where she had grown up. Shoshone. So in the Rocky Mountains, present day Idaho.
That's where she was captured.
That's right.
I know the tribe.
Exactly. And then taken more than 500 miles away from her family. And let's underline, she was 12 when this happened. 13. So this is happening to somebody who's still a child, and it's unbelievable the amount of difficulty and despair that could bring into somebody, and I'm sure it did for her. But then she was able to find a way to make her own choices, protect her son once she was born. She was a very smart person. She was a very kind person. She was a very resilient person. She's one of the stars of the book.
Just think of the trauma of her being captured, like with Otter Woman, her young friend.
Yeah. There was one woman that she was captured with who then ran away, and then Charbonneau ended up owning another woman named Otter Woman. And one of the things I put in the book, you know, we don't have letters from Sacagawea, so we can't know exactly what happened. So I'm very careful in these moments to say things like, this might have happened, this probably happened. But one thing I like to think about is, when Charbonneau was a trader, when he left on those missions, then all of a sudden their teepee is just Sacagawea and Otter Woman. They can speak in Shoshone. They can be there for each other. They can look out for each other. And I think that relationship between two women must have sustained them both. But then Otter Woman wasn't able to go on the expedition. So it was bitter. Even this triumph for Sacagawea had to feel bittersweet.
She was separated from her friend.
Right. She got to go home, but her friend, who was also Shoshone, didn't get to go home.
I know it. And she was pregnant through a lot of this, and then she has a child on this journey. And I thought the Corps, they kind of adopted this child, didn't they?
Yeah, there was a real kindness that seemed to develop between them. And, you know,
Pompey.
Right, Pompey is the name of the son. And long after the expedition, Patrick Gass, one of the soldiers, had a cat. He named it Sacagawea. So you can tell there were connections that were made. They worked together. They found things that they cared about each other. And so Pompey was somebody that they looked out for. And especially there was a time when Sacagawea became very, very ill. I think based on the journals, what's most likely is that Charbonneau had given her a sexually transmitted infection and that it flared up. And so she was very close to dying. During this time, somebody had to look out for Pompey. Charbonneau wasn't even in the camp. So it's fair to assume that the men did the best they could to take care of this baby. They were all in it together. You know, they were trying to get to the ocean together.
And Pompey became Jean-Baptiste?
Yeah, he went on to have a very long and important life in the West, spent some time in Europe. A really fascinating person who went on plenty of adventures of his own.
That's another book.
Yeah, maybe. There we go.
Right. Okay. I found this very interesting, Craig Furman, that the Spanish sent out troops to try and stop the Lewis and Clark expedition. A couple of times they sent out an expedition.
Four times for sure that we know.
Four times.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
And they came really close. Like, we think about how big the interior of the continent is. A couple times they were within 100 miles. And so if they had just pushed a little bit further, or if they had gotten there 2 days earlier or 2 days later, we might have had a geopolitical standoff. This is, you know, my book's an adventure story, but I think it's kind of a geopolitical thriller too, because you don't just have America versus the Lakota versus the Blackfoot versus the Mandan. Spain's involved, France is involved, Britain's certainly involved. So you have all these nations all very powerful, all very strategic, sort of feeling each other out. And yeah, the Spanish worked really hard to try to track Lewis and Clark down. They never succeeded, but Jefferson was sending out other expeditions, and the Spanish apprehended two of those expeditions and arrested one of them and forced the other to turn back. So it's just a reminder that what Lewis and Clark was able to accomplish, it seems sort of automatic today. But at that moment, in that time, it was precarious. It was scary. It was hard. And that just makes their story more exciting.
Yeah, the obstacles are incredible, and the challenges facing these explorers, the rapids, the Sawyers, I thought that was interesting.
Yeah.
The logs in the river that they run into.
And they get stuck there by mud, and then you might only see a little bit of it up top, but of course your boat's got, the draft is a little bit under the water. Mm. You hit one of those, you puncture your boat, or even worse, your boat turns, and then the current sort of causes it to capsize or spin. There's just so many ways the banks could cave in. The river was a living, breathing thing, and that was their first challenge every day. How do we move these boats? How do we move all our supplies? Mm-hmm. It was a logistical nightmare, and it's amazing what they were able to accomplish.
And they had never seen grizzly bears before. They knew about black bears,
right?
But grizzly was like twice their size and more ferocious.
The first time one of the men dealt with a grizzly bear, he shot at him, and the grizzly bear started chasing him, and the man just left his gun and stuff and just took off running and escaped, thankfully. We talk about only one man died. It's amazing 10 men didn't die just in these encounters with grizzly bears, because they were extremely violent and extremely fierce. And then, of course, Lewis gets out with his tape measure and measures the claws and cuts him open to examine the heart. And, you know, he's a scientist, too. So it's all of these things all at once.
Yeah, the fact that Lewis collected flora and fauna along the way is incredible. Mm-hmm. They captured a prairie dog for him.
That
was cool.
Yeah, there was a lot of work. They were hard to capture. What they ended up having to do is flush them out, because they've got these burrows underground, these labyrinthine networks. So they poured water in there, finally flushed one out, because they wanted to capture one alive, and they mailed it all the way back to Jefferson.
I thought that was cool.
And it made it back there. The prairie dog made it to the White House. But what's funny is that it became kind of a partisan fight, in that Jefferson's party was like, look, this expedition is working. Look at this scientific discovery. And then the people on the other side of the aisle were like, that's not really a prairie dog. That's not new. That's actually just related to animals we already know about.
It's a marmot.
Yeah, exactly. It's just a marmot. And it's just, you know, I mean, how much does that feel like today, where you've got two sides of the aisle fighting about something trivial? Well, it was happening back then, too.
My guest is Craig Fuhrman, author of This Vast Enterprise, A New History of Lewis and Clark, as we celebrate the nation's 250th anniversary. Coming up, Crossing the Mountains, Finally Reaching the Pacific, and The Long Journey Home. And along the way, Captain Lewis is wounded, shot in the butt. Wow. And the epilogue, What Happened to the Crew When They Reached Home? Did Clark free York from slavery? And there's a shocking suicide and a bittersweet farewell to Sacagawea. I'm David James. This is 2 Main Street. We'll be right back. Welcome back to 2 Main Street. I'm David James. If you are just joining us, we are reliving the epic journey of Meriwether Lewis and William Clark, 8,000 miles over 2 years, exploring the Louisiana Purchase, hoping to find a direct water route from St. Louis to the Pacific. My guest is Craig Fuhrman, a graduate of the University of Southern Indiana and author of the new book, The Vast Enterprise. The Corps of Discovery makes it to the headwaters of the Missouri. They face the mountains and discover there is no direct water route, is there?
That's right. What I like to think of is that they didn't fail so much as the topography failed them. They were looking for something that just didn't exist, and they had to make terms with that, but that was not easy. You know, they thought that they were going to find something. They didn't find it, and there were lots of ripple effects from that.
And that was the mission.
That was the mission.
To
find that quick water route, because that had implications for American empire, for American trade, for all sorts of things. And so when that's not there, they had to sort of regroup, but they also had to just get across the mountains because, right, you know, finding that's not there is one thing, but they still need to get to the ocean. They still need to complete the mission.
Crossing the mountains was no easy task, was it?
It was. I mean, we've talked about them eating horses, and that's when it happened, because they ran out of food. It was easy to get lost. Some days it would be so hot that there would be wasps stinging their horses. They were able to trade through for horses from the Shoshone. Sacagawea played an essential role in the Shoshone agreeing to meet with them and trade with them. So, you know, one day it's so hot, wasps are stinging their horses. The next day there's snow on the ground, and if they want something to drink, they just have to grab a handful of snow and melt it on a fire. Their moccasins freeze to the ground. So those weather extremes, the altitude, it was one of the absolute hardest parts of the mission.
And you even talk about the mosquitoes, too, that they had to face.
Yeah. And again, you can see Lewis tried to anticipate this. Lewis is a smart guy. He brought mosquito netting for everybody, even Pompey on Sacagawea's back in his little carrier. he had mosquito netting to try to keep him, somewhat safe from these pests. Mm-hmm. But over time, the mosquito netting rips. It's not like there's a replacement. There's no target there. So you just make the best of it.
Right. Okay. They finally crossed the mountains after this arduous journey. They reached the Pacific Ocean. What was that like when they saw the Pacific?
Well, it was bittersweet, like a lot of things on the back half of the expedition. They were glad to have finally made it. That was a big moment for a lot of people, and that was very meaningful. But also, they were miserable. The rain in the Pacific Northwest, I think by some counts, they spent a whole winter there, and there were only 3 or 4 days where it didn't rain. Mm-hmm. So they were constantly soaked with water. That's not fun to begin mm-hmm. with, but it made it hard to preserve their food, so they were having to eat spoiled meat. Their relationships with the native people weren't as warm and understanding as they were in other parts.
Was it?
Koboi, one of the best people in the book, I think, and definitely a place where the interviews were so meaningful because I talked to people who were his descendants today.
Oh, really?
And they really helped me understand his perspective. I think Lewis and Clark did not do right by Koboi. I think I can understand why. They were out of trade gifts. They couldn't give Koboi one of those Grand Chief packages we were talking about. They were out of merchandise. They had not found what they were looking for. So there were reasons for them to be upset. But Koboi tried to deal with them. Koboi tried to be fair with them, and they were just kind of surly in return. But the ocean was bittersweet. They had made it, but they hadn't found exactly what they were looking for.
So they finally, the weather breaks, and they head back home. Mm-hmm. As this journey begins back home, back in Washington, an Indian delegation is meeting with the president. Piahito? Is that right?
Yeah, Biahito, sort of pronounced with a B.
Oh, with a B, Biahito. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. And what was that? What kind of reception did they receive in Washington?
Well, if you want to talk about only knowing half the story, this is, I think, maybe the best example, because I can't think of anything else that's been written about Lewis and Clark that really takes these delegations seriously. But I crunched the numbers here, and Lewis and Clark cost more than $100,000, which is a lot of money today. But in 1803, that's an insane amount of money. That's a bigger portion of the federal budget than NASA takes up today. Hmm. And more than half of that money went not to the boat, not to bullets, but went to these native delegations. One of the things Jefferson asked Lewis to do was, when you meet with important native leaders, tell them we'll give them a taxpayer-funded trip to Washington. So while Lewis and Clark are going thousands of miles to the west, these native leaders are going thousands of miles to the east to meet with Jefferson in Washington. And a number of them went, and the one I decided to give his own chapter to kind of get in his perspective was Biahito. He was an amazing guy, great sense of humor, very savvy diplomat. And he traveled more than 2,000 miles, met with Jefferson in Washington, D.C., and sort of said, you know, these are my people. This is our land. This is what we want from you. He went to the White House and was a diplomat for his people.
And he wined and dined with the leaders in Washington.
That's right. Jefferson's famous dinners. Biahito was there showing mm-hmm. them things. He had a map that he made. He was very fluent in plain sign language. Jefferson was impressed by him. These were two aging men who were brilliant, who were fluent in many languages. I think they probably found a lot to see in each other and appreciate.
But he didn't make it home, did he?
No, and that's one of the bittersweet parts of the way back is that Biahito died. He was older. It was probably just some kind of sickness, but there were real ripple effects from this. There were unintended consequences. If you think of Lewis and Clark as foreign policy, and they were, we're here in America's 250th anniversary. If you want to understand, the American story, Lewis and Clark is a great place to start because they were the first attempt to do a lot of these things. The White House wasn't finished yet. Yes, Jefferson was having his dinners and his wine lists, but there were plaster chunks that could fall off the wall. America was literally still being built. Mm-hmm. And so Lewis and Clark was this first attempt at foreign policy. And what did the Americans try to do? They tried to pick new leaders. They tried to change other nations. And there were unintended consequences. So Biahito dying, by the time that news travels 2,000 miles back to his people, they don't believe the Jefferson's story. They don't believe that he died of natural causes. They're angry at the Americans. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, the Americans versus the Arikara become a really important flashpoint on the Missouri for decades after that point. It all happened because of the Lewis and Clark expedition. It's a ripple effect.
Okay, the Corps begins the long journey home. They've made it to the Pacific. Now they're going to go back to St. Louis. Mm-hmm. And en route, Captain Lewis is shot. Mm-hmm. How'd that happen?
Well, he was just trying to do his job. He was trying to get some astronomical measurements, using his sextant, using his oxtant to get the data that would help Clark make this big map, which is one of the things they would produce. So they stopped. They didn't get there quite in time. They were a couple minutes late for the sun's position to measure it. So they're going to have to kill some time and measure it a little bit later on. And you can see these kind of butterfly wing moments where one small thing like that right. can ripple out. So because they're a couple minutes late, they can't get the measurement. They got to kill time. So Lewis thinks, I'm going to go kill some elk. We need the skins for clothes. We need the food to eat. Well, he's hunting with somebody else and somebody else accidentally shoots. Lewis at this point is dressed in deer skin or elk skin himself, so he kind of looks like an elk. And this man shoots at him and hits Lewis in the buttocks. And it's a very terrible wound. He's lucky that it didn't clip any bones or nerves or anything like that, but a lot of blood, a lot of fear, because Lewis's first thought was, are we under attack? And so this became a moment that really, I think, defined Lewis's trip back. They're trying to get back as quickly as they can, but Lewis just has to lay in the bottom of the boat, right, face down. He can't, you know, he's worried, am I getting an infection? Am I going to die from this? I didn't find the Northwest Passage, that water connection, and now am I going to die of an infection being shot by my own man in the butt? You can see why that would weigh on him and cause him to kind of really grapple with despair, those kinds of things we've talked about with him.
And William Clark was kind of like the camp doctor, wasn't he?
Yeah, Clark was. Lewis did a lot of the doctoring on the first half, but I think one way you can see that Lewis was struggling in the second half of the expedition is that Clark, there was never any written document or anything like that. Clark just sort of said, I want to help my friend out. I'm going to do more of this. And so he did more and more of the doctoring. I think it's a way to show him trying to help his friend out. But unfortunately, because of that errant shot, he ended up having to doctor his friend. And let's be honest, Lewis was a terrible patient. Clark says, you know, no walking. He leaves. He comes back. Lewis has walked all over the place and re-aggravated the injury. Lewis was just a very headstrong and stubborn and energetic person. And that makes it hard to heal.
Right. Oh, so, okay, this ragged band of explorers, and I'm sure they looked really ragged when they reached St. Louis on September 23rd, 1806. What was the reception in St. Louis?
Well, people couldn't believe it. Everyone thought they were dead. They had started to meet traders as they got closer and closer who were doing their deal. And those traders would say, everybody thinks you're dead. The president still has some hope, but everybody else assumes you're gone. Mm-hmm. So the reaction in St. Louis was rapturous. People were enthralled. People made some jokes. They said they kind of looked like Robinson Crusoe, which is what you're talking about. You know, they don't have the clothes. Everything's been worn out. Everything's been destroyed. But people were excited. There were toasts. There were celebrations. And that happened as they slowly made their way from St. Louis to Washington. It happened around the world. This was an international story. So many people were interested in the North American continent in different empires. And so finally, somebody had crossed it. Somebody was ready to map it from the European or the imperial perspective. This was a big story, and Lewis and Clark became celebrities. Their men became celebrities. Bea Ito became a celebrity.
Meriwether Lewis is a hero, but he didn't finish his journal that he wanted to write.
Right.
And then he commits suicide.
Yeah.
Dark side.
Yeah.
And was it in Tennessee? Is that where it happened?
That's right. He was on a road called the Natchez Trace. He was coming back. We talked about honor. Once Jefferson was replaced by Madison, some new government officials from a new administration sort of questioned the way Lewis was doing some things. He had become governor of the Louisiana Territory. And so Lewis took that very personally. He was very angry, and so he went back. But there are a lot of other signs. Like, Clark met with him to kind of review his finances. Lewis was in financial trouble. And Clark wrote something like, you know, when we parted, I would have been happy if his mind was fine, but his mind was not. And so it's really heartbreaking. On the way back on that road, somebody was with Lewis, and Lewis started talking to Clark. Clark's hundreds of miles away. He's not there. And Lewis is saying things out loud like, I always knew you'd come rescue me. I knew you were my friend. I knew you'd be there when I needed me. Clark's not even there. Lewis was clearly just in a very dark place. And in the end, he decided that the pain of being alive was worse than the pain of being dead. And that's why he took his own life.
And he shot himself?
That's right, twice.
Okay. Now, William Clark becomes a general, right?
Mm-hmm.
Gets married, and he names his first son after Meriwether Lewis.
That's right.
That was interesting.
Yeah, that relationship continued. They even lived together for a little bit in St. Louis when Clark was a newlywed. I doubt Clark's wife was a big fan of that arrangement, but they made it work.
Okay.
But yeah, Clark became a very important diplomat and was, you know, when you talked about the Louisiana Purchase, slowly those territories getting purchased and deals being made, Clark was kind of the point man for that for decades after the expedition.
Mm-hmm. Okay, what happened to William Clark's slave, York?
This might be the most bittersweet part of all, because when York got back, York had changed. York had asserted himself. And so he said to Clark, I've done enough to earn my freedom. And I crunched the numbers. You know, if you look at what the regular soldiers were paid on this expedition, it was much more value than what you would have taken for York to buy his own freedom. I think York had a very compelling case, but Clark wouldn't give it to him. Clark wanted things to go back to the way they were before the expedition, where York was my servant, my boy, that he was just kind of an extension of him. And I think it's interesting to see that York fought back this time. And that shows you how much the expedition changed him. Clark treated him one way before the expedition. We don't have any record of issues. After the expedition, Clark treats him this way, and York stands up for himself and says, this isn't right. This isn't how I want to be treated. Unfortunately, Clark doesn't free him until more than a decade after the expedition, and York almost certainly dies shortly after that. So you would like to see a story where York wasn't the only one who changed on the expedition. Clark changed too, but once he got back to America, he sort of re-embraced that institution of slavery, and York and his family felt the price.
York was married.
That's right. He was married to a woman in Louisville, and that certainly exacerbated things because Clark moved to St. Louis to take this new important government job, and he could have let York stay in Louisville. He could have sold York to somebody in Louisville. There are many things he could have done that would have been kinder, but instead he was like, nope, you're coming with me. And York was furious because he wanted to be with his wife.
Separated him again from his wife.
Exactly.
Wow.
York had no choice.
Now, Sacagawea, what happened to Sacagawea?
This is a tricky one. There are a lot of different traditions, and we can't, you know, there are people who are kind of working on DNA testing here, although I think this question will be a lot harder to answer that way. But what we know happened for sure is she tried to live in St. Louis for a little while, didn't really like it. So eventually Pompey started to live with Clark, and Clark sort of paid for Pompey's schooling. I think actually the federal government paid for Pompey's schooling. And so Sacagawea and Charbonneau went back out into the Great West. And the best written evidence we have is that she died around 1812. She had another child, and Clark became the legal guardian for that child too. But there are also native traditions that she didn't die then, that she lived a long time after that. And the written documents, they talk about a Shoshone woman who was the wife of Charbonneau, but they don't say Sacagawea. They're not as precise as, you know, a death certificate would be for today. So the way I see it, we don't really know exactly what happened to her, but the fact that there are so many possibilities, I think that just speaks to what an appealing woman she was and what an amazing and inspiring character that so many people can see their stories in her.
So the nation is celebrating its 250th anniversary. What's the legacy of the Lewis and Clark Corps of Discovery?
Well, I think, you know, I tried to tell a story that had all these different elements in it. But if we're going to focus on the American element, I think it's just really the expedition itself is a very American story. It's confident. It's swaggering. Mm-hmm. They wanted to make the world a better place, but they were also so sure that their way was going to make the world a better place that maybe they didn't listen as much as they should. And then there are also darker legacies that you know, their work laid the foundation for America to make imperial claims on the Pacific Northwest. And mm-hmm. then people like Cobaway we talked about, they ended up losing a lot of their land and losing a lot of their sovereignty because America claimed that land. And then the Oregon Trail opened up and lots of settlers started flooding in. Jefferson and other presidents would often say, we're not going to take natives people's land without their consent. We'll make deals. We'll do this in the right way. But that was kind of the theory among elites. What actually happened is that people got their wagons and they went where there was land because the settlers wanted land and needed land. And so there was always a gap between sort of the intentions and the reality. And for many Native people, the reality was brutal.
All right. My thanks to Craig Fairman, author of This Vast Enterprise. It's a great read. It's an adventure story.
That's what I tried for.
Thanks for being my guest.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
I'm David James, and this is 2 Main Street.
2 Main Street on WNIN-FM airs Thursday at noon and Saturday at 11. And previous shows are on demand at WNIN.org.